Welcome back to Remember What's Next, Season 3. This is the podcast where we explore the intersection of Jewish history and modern-day challenges. I'm Ellie Bass, a Jewish educator, healer, and coach, and joining me once again is Rabbi Ken Spiro. He's an author, educator, and world-renowned Israel tour guide and historical pundit. In this season, we'll be examining the vital importance of Jewish unity. Throughout history, the Jewish people have faced countless obstacles and challenges, yet have always managed to survive and thrive due to their unity and sense of collective purpose when we can muster it. We'll examine the clashes and collaborations between ancient traditions and modern innovations and explore how these interactions can shape a better future for everyone. We're jumping into the unique challenges and opportunities facing the Jewish community in the modern era, and how our unity can help us confront these challenges and build a brighter future for all. So join us on this journey of discussion, learning, and inspiration as we remember the past, discover the present, and explore what's next for the Jewish people. Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back, Rabbi Spiro.
Good to be back, as always.
We are digging into a topic that I actually don't know a lot about. It's definitely not something that is, you know, sort of taught, you know, definitely not in the conversion process and not necessarily even talked about on a regular basis. But I think, you know, in terms of our podcast and using history in order to understand the present and the future, is such a fascinating piece of context to have in terms of what we're dealing with now. So what are we going to talk about, and where does this take us?
Yeah, so Ellie, we know our podcast is Remember What's Next. It's how the, you know, looking at the present, understanding how it relates to the past, which is this whole idea that Judaism brought into the world, that history is a control process leading to a destination, that there's a plot to the story, there's an end to the story, and nothing happens by accident. So while, you know, we tend to focus on the real-time current events and the geopolitical realities, I think it's really important to pull back and look at how this fits into the grand scheme, the big picture of Jewish history, and especially the end part of the story, which is clearly where we are now. There's an interesting tradition in Judaism that's brought down in the Talmud that there's 6,000 years of normative history, which begins at the end of day six of creation. That's when sort of God takes the watch off of his hand, so to speak, and gives it to Adam and says, start keeping time from your perspective. You know, a day is the earth rotating once on its axis. Mm-hmm. And if you look where we are now in that story, you know, that just as there's 6 days of creation, the rabbis learn that every day of creation is not only equivalent to a day of the week that we use nowadays, but that it's equivalent to 1,000 years of human history. And if we're in 5,784, which is where we are, then that means we are in, without going, taking a lot of time to explain the mathematics, we're late Friday afternoon. Remember, Jewish weeks end with the Sabbath. And in the grand scheme of Jewish history, we have this idea that there's 6,000 years of normative history. There's a transitional period, which would be equivalent to twilight. You know, when the sun goes down on Friday night before the stars come out, it's no longer the normal workaday week, but it's not the Sabbath yet.
Wouldn't the year 6,000 be Friday and then 7,000? No, 5,000
is Friday. You're asking a great question. Everyone gets confused on that. Just as the first day of the 21st century was January 1st of the year 2000, so too when you hit the year 5,000, you are actually in the sixth millennia. When you hit the year 6,000, you're in the seventh millennia, which is the Sabbath of human history. And just like Shabbat is a different reality than the rest of the week, there's a different energy. It's a day that you can rejuvenate yourself, all puns intended, in a different way. So too, the seventh millennia, which begins with the year 6,000, is called Olam Haba, the world to come, which is, by the way, not to do a talk on that now. That's a different topic. Maybe we'll talk about it at a different time. But Olam Haba is when the world goes back to the way it was before the tree of knowledge and Adam blowing it and us getting ejected from the garden. The ideas of resurrection of the dead and final judgment, which are concepts that, you know, haven't happened yet. We're not going to talk about those now. That takes place then. But there's a transitional period, like I said, which corresponds to that twilight period. It's not no longer the normal workaday week. The sun is set, but the stars haven't come out. When I say stars coming out, in Jewish law, the new day begins. Jewish days begin at night. And you see three stars. That's twilight. The twilight of human history is the messianic era, which, by the way, Islam and Christianity have similar concepts. And they got it from us. The whole idea of Messiah, which is a topic, I don't know if we've done an episode on it or not, but it's a very interesting topic. But the concept is originally a Jewish concept. The Messiah is not the end of history. The Messiah is the short version of the class is he's a catalyst, like in chemistry. Hmm. It's a human being with certain leadership skills, lineage, who has a certain job description of things he has to accomplish. And his job is to basically set the stage for us to transition out of normative history into that final phase, that seventh millennia that begins in the year 6000, which is called the world to come. And Jewish tradition says the Messiah has to come and complete the job by the year 6000, which if you do your math and you take 6000 and you subtract 5,784 from it, you got 216 years left. That's a maximum, by the way. It's like your teacher gives you you have 3 months to do your term paper.
Right.
You pull it all night the night before and finish it when you've wasted, you wasted the last 3 months.
As we all do.
But that's a maximum. There's a lot, again, we're not going to go into it now, but there's a lot of Jewish sources that indicate that, and I don't even need Jewish sources, that we don't have 216 years left. And I'm not talking about climate change. I'm talking about the rapidity with which change is taking place, especially within what's going on in the Middle East and Israel. So we're clearly, if you stand back and look and understand the signs and what's talked about in the Bible about what's going to happen, we're clearly approaching that period of time, which is sort of like the climax of the epic movie, the end of Harry Potter or the Matrix or the Star Wars.
Right.
Or
it's all coming to a head, the crescendo of the final battle. I want to just throw in, because I think, for those of us, even sometimes in the religious community or the not religious community, we get a little like itchy under the skin when it comes to talking about the fulfillment of prophecy, when it comes to saying, things about Mashiach or things about, end of days. I think definitely in the Western world, we've been so inundated and colored by the Christian narrative in that way, which seems magical and far-fetched and fairyland, that it sometimes makes a lot of people, I feel, very uncomfortable to talk about this part of Jewish philosophy, belief, and theology. So I just kind of want to mention that, because I definitely know that some people hear this idea of end of days and resurrection of the dead and Mashiach, and they're like, ooh, like that seems pretty out there. Like, I'm good with like Passover, but the idea that there's going to be some Messiah that's going to change the whole world back to the way it was in Gan Eden makes me feel a little like, weird. So, how do we deal with that? What do we do with that? And then how do we live with that idea?
Right. Well, so first of all, I think even people who buy into the narrative, the traditional Jewish narrative of history is a controlled process leading to a destination, supernatural things happening, yada, yada, yada. Even those people, myself included, it actually happens. It's like, it's actually happening. Oh my God.
Right.
I would say 9/11, when I remember what was happening, because everyone remembers these events. I remember where I was standing, what I was looking at. 9/11 gave us an experience of seeing something that is unimaginable, that is really happening before our eyes.
Right. Yeah.
But we also have to remember, Ellie, that, the problem with, Ben-Gurion, Dave Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, who was not the slightest bit religious, but he knew his Bible and his history very well. He had one of my favorite lines. He said, to be a realist as a Jew, you have to believe in miracles.
Yeah.
The reality is so that true. We kind of associate supernatural with suspension of the laws of nature. And it doesn't have to be that way. Sure, in the Bible, there's seas splitting and supernatural plagues destroying superpower empires like ancient Egypt. But a lot of what is, we call miraculous is just natural phenomena with incredibly good timing and often sometimes really good aim. So it doesn't have to be a suspension of the laws of nature, so to speak. But if you actually stand back, and I speak about this all the time, because I always say I wear my two hats, my rabbi hat and my historian hat, is right. That all of Jewish history, this is why Ben-Gurion is saying this line, as someone who's a non-believer, you know, all of Jewish history, if you stand back and look at it, it defies all the laws of human history, you know, to outlast all the greatest empires, the dozens of peoples who try to destroy us, who are now in history books and museums, and we're still here, you know, to be exiled twice, come back to our land, reestablish our state, surrounded by literally millions of hostile people who want us dead, you know, in the middle of a desert, you know, and then the desert blooms and it's exporting, you know, fruit and vegetables and technology to the rest of the world. And, you know, that a half of 1% of the Jews in the world lived here 120 years ago. And now more than half the Jews in the world live in the land of Israel. And it goes on and on and on. It really is all supernatural. But the problem is when it happens to you every day, what's the supernatural becomes natural and normal.
Right. So like people, when you're in it, you don't think of it as unusual. But if you were to sort of zoom out, it would be like reading a science fiction novel. You'd be like, yeah, that's crazy. That could never happen.
Exactly. Exactly. And actually, the last book I wrote, Destiny, is dealing with that, you know, that all the story beats of the great, all these epic movie trilogies and more, you know, like Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter and The Matrix and Star Wars. The story beats match Jewish history. Wow. Everything about us and who we are and what we've accomplished. In the words of Mark Twain, with our hands tied behind us, that the most hated people in the world have been most transformative and have outlasted all the people who tried to kill us. It's all supernatural. So it's not like lightning bolts are going to come from heaven and Caesar necessarily going to split. We could have that. You know, God has, you know, the best logical, rational, scientific explanation for miracles is God can do whatever he likes. Mm-hmm. If there is an all-powerful, all-knowing, infinite being, and the human, and it's like a computer programmer and a software. He can program whatever he wants to the computer.
Right, God, and he can write whatever code he wants.
Yeah, and generally speaking, this is the real issue, and this is where we are now, Ellie, is that I hold that God put laws of nature into the world, and he generally doesn't like to mess with them, like that old Parquet margarine commercial for those of us who are 1,000 years old and remember, you know, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. You know, it's not, God doesn't generally like to suspend the laws of nature. He has done it a few times, especially at the beginning of our history, to demonstrate clearly and unequivocally that he controls everything. But generally speaking, I say that miracles in Jewish history are natural phenomena with just really good timing and like sometimes really good aim. So we have to put that in the back of our head and not think necessarily in the terms of this is all going to be science fiction and aliens landing or something like that. It's not going to be that way, I don't believe.
Right. I think sometimes we think about the idea of miracle and we literally think it will come with unicorn sparkles around it, you know, like it will, and there'll be a sign that points to it saying, this is a miracle. And whereas it's often very quiet, like you said, it just sort of, you look back and you're like, wait a second, like, what are the chances that things happened exactly the way that they needed to? But at the time, you could blink and miss it.
Exactly. Exactly. I always give an example, by the way, of like, because I was an astronomy freak as a kid, you know, meteorites, the Earth is hit by literally billions of tons of matter every year. Almost all of it burns up in the atmosphere and you see it as shooting stars, they're called. Mm. But occasionally they hit the Earth, you know, 65 million years ago, a piece of rock the size of a football field hit the Yucatan Peninsula and created what's called in honor of you and Ellie, an extinction level event. Where it threw up so much dust and garbage into the earth that it killed pretty much off everything in the world, except for, you know, like a few, like most, all the dinosaurs were killed off. But right. So a meteorite is a completely natural explainable phenomenon, and people have seen shooting stars, but very few people have merited to see a piece of rock hit the planet Earth from space. But like I say, imagine you're in some really nasty, you know, American city with a very high crime rate, let's say you're in Detroit and walking in a place you shouldn't be. And a guy pulls you into an alley, pulls out a gun. He's some sociopathic guy who wants to shoot you for your sneakers. And just as he's about to pull the trigger because he doesn't care about you at all, a meteorite, completely natural, explainable phenomenon, streaks from outer space, like hits him in the hand, like shatters his hand. The gun goes flying. He falls down on the ground screaming in pain. What do you say? Oh, wow. What a great convergence of completely explainable natural phenomena.
Wow. That was, you know, helpfully like, random.
It's a miracle, you know? But again, when it's happening, we don't have the perspective to see what's going on. So that's why we really have to. And what I'm hoping we do now, and I think my intuition is telling me we're going to have to continue this discussion into our next episode, is to really pull back and see, you know, what traditionally Judaism says about the process of redemption and what specifically is said about the end game, the final showdown, because we also have to appreciate, you know, I mentioned my book, Destiny, that the plot of all the great Hollywood epics is really just mirroring Jewish history, because I believe it's kind of in the collective human consciousness. These movies all turn out the same way. It's because that's the way we kind of feel on the deepest level. This is the way it has to be. Meaning, look at any of these movies, pick Star Wars, you know, Harry Potter, whatever you could think of. I don't know, whatever movies there are, Chronicles of Narnia, The Matrix, they're all the same. Like the world descends into darkness. There's some big power that's kind of crushing humanity. And there's a little superhero who doesn't even know he's the hero sometimes and doesn't even want the job. But because his role, he has this huge outsized role way beyond who he is as an individual. He can't escape his destiny. So he's kind of thrown into a confrontation with a force that's far greater, more powerful than he is. Mm-hmm. And according to all the laws of human history and all the odds, he should have lost and been destroyed many times over. But miraculously, although always kind of explainably, he manages to survive, sometimes barely. Mm-hmm. And all these different strengths come out in the course of his journey, the hero's journey. And in the end, he's thrown into a final confrontation with the big bad guy, and he wins. And evil is destroyed, good wins, the balance is destroyed, and light returns. And that is, I'm telling you, literally, that's my book. You can literally take the story of each and show this is Jewish history. This is the reality. And we are in, just as any of these, whether it's, you know, 5-6 books, Harry Potter, whatever, or the movies, the final showdown is the final showdown, which takes place at the end of the story. That's exactly what we are clearly approaching now, not just because of the math of the, you know, the 6,000 minus the 5,784 years, but because of what is starting to fall into place that has never been in place before.
Okay, give us an example, like what's falling into place.
I mean, first of all, the whole, you know, if you look at the idea of the messianic era, which is, you know, the Messiah kind of finishes off the process, but the whole notion of the physical return, I mentioned this before, of the physical return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel is an unprecedented phenomenon. No nation ever lost its homeland twice, went into exile, was scattered around the world, survived, came back and reestablished a state. That is unique to the Jewish people. That's happened. Like I said, the fact that now, you know, literally a half of 1% of the Jews in the world were living here 120 years ago, and now there's at least half the Jews in the world are living in Israel. This is part of that process. You know, it's interesting that if you look in, there's no tractate of the oral law, the Mishnah or the Talmud, which is the laws of Messiah, so to speak. Maimonides, who's the best source on all of this, the great medieval Jewish scholar going back to, you know, basically he died in 1205. He says that the details we don't know, but he says, but if you look, and I'm just paraphrasing him in a big way now, he says it, but if you look at what is implied primarily in the books of the prophets about what we expect to see at the end of days, if I give you like the Hebrew Bible and tell you to read to the books of the prophets and those chapters to talk about the redemption with, and take a pad and a paper, if people still use that stuff, or take your you know, your computer and type out what is going to happen. You see that physical return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel is part of the process of redemption. Spiritual return of the Jewish people to Judaism, tshuva as it's called, the whole Baal Tshuva movement is part of the messianic redemptive process. And again, we don't appreciate that because Baal Tshuva movement and outreach is so ubiquitous today. It's so everywhere in the world. But my rabbi, Rabbi Noach Weinberg, when he taught, and he's really one of the founders of the whole Baal Tshuva movement idea, he used to tell the story, and he passed away 16 years ago. I remember him telling the story when he was a young man, and he would tell his relatives, you know, that he had turned two Jews onto Judaism, and his relatives would mock him. This is like, I'm talking about, this is like, you know, the 1950s, early 1950s. Right. They'd say like, Noach, great rabbis would have loved to have on their tombstone that they had saved one Jew's soul. Who do you think you are? You know, so the notion now, you have literally a good chunk of the religious world is Baal Tshuva. You're in Toronto. You know, you go to this whole synagogues are virtually entirely. I just came back from South Africa. 90% of the Jewish community in South Africa are Baal Tshuva, are people who were not raised religious who came back to Judaism. That is part of that process. So you have a physical return, you have a spiritual return. These are things that have never been in place before. People say, oh yeah, but you can always read into it. Yes, the Jews came back once before, going back before, you know, after the destruction of the first temple, but the prophecies were of scattering around the world. You know, in the destruction of the first temple, we just lived in one place. There was one diaspora community, which was Babylon, which is Iraq today. So that hadn't happened yet. So we go off, we're scattered around the world, and we come back from that. So there's many things that are in place that are just not anything that we've seen before. The reestablishment of a Jewish state is clearly the strongest sign of that. The fact that we are able to reestablish, that the Jewish people are one of the probably the only people who speak the same language, worship the same God, live in the same country, have the same capital city, have the same set of laws. You know, even the few ancient people like the Chinese who have lasted a really long time, right, even their capital city has been, you know, Nanking, Beijing, you know, everything about us, we're the newest old nation on the planet Earth. But again, it's just like, okay, but we're so used to it because supernatural for us is natural. So we don't appreciate. And also the fact that, you know, we are so small, that the fundamental idea that we've talked about before of who we are as a nation is we're supposed to be a role model for the world, that a people that have been so hated more than any other people. I mean, anti-Semitism is the longest, most irrational, deepest universal hatred on the planet Earth. And from people like that, we shouldn't even be here, much less be able to impact the world. Most people in human history who are stressed go into an aggressive phase.
Right.
And their creativity and productivity crashes.
Freeze. It happens. Right.
Yeah. Jews are like, we're like an orange. You squeeze us and the juice comes out.
Yeah. There's a great book called Anti-Fragile. You know, that talks about how there are certain, look, truthfully, most humans are built this way, that you actually get stronger with pressure, the things that you have to break in order for them to bloom. And definitely, like, the Jewish people are, and Rabbi Sacks talks about this a lot, that within Judaism, there is no concept of victimhood. There's just, you know, this is what's happening. What do we do with what's happening in order to build a future that we can control? We can't control what's happening, but we can control the future that we build from it. So I think it's such an interesting, unique piece of, like, spiritual DNA within the Jewish people. That's
very interesting you say that. By the way, I hear the point, you know, they say what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Or the Spanish say what doesn't kill fattens, but that's a separate topic. But that I see works on an individual level, but collectively as a society, I'm not aware of any other people who have been traumatized and have come back so strongly, even in the middle of being traumatized. Like, you look at the productivity and the creativity of, like, the period of the Rishonim, which is, you know, a period of time going back 500 years, which corresponds to things like, you know, expulsion of Spain and at the end of that period, or, you know, the Crusades and things like that. You have some of the greatest Jewish minds coming out with some of the most amazing things. That's quite unique in Jewish history. But you talk about there's no idea of victimhood in Judaism. That's a really interesting point. And I never really thought about that when you said it. It really clicked something in my brain, because we are the people who taught the world that, like I said, history is a control process. You know, that there's an infinite producer director out there who scripted the story, but that we have, when you have the right hashkafa, the correct Jewish worldview, when you appreciate that we have a contractual agreement with God, you understand that there's a cause and effect going on in the world. When we look at science, we understand cause and effect, but you have to appreciate the same infinite being that put laws into science, like laws of gravity, which enable us to survive. Even before we learned physics, we knew about gravity. And you tried to stand up when you were little, you dropped food from the high chair, but it enabled us to survive because we know, you know, that it's predictable laws of reality. We Jews understand that there's metaphysical, spiritual, historical laws of reality. God put rules to the game, and we're kind of in a contractual agreement with God. And therefore, when we understand that, and that's interesting, I have a collection of a couple of volumes of a book called Letters of Jews Throughout the Ages.
I remember you've mentioned those in a couple of episodes.
I did. Okay, maybe. Okay, I did. Possibly, yes. And it's just random letters. Some of them are from some very famous people. A lot of them from just people whose letters survived. And some of them lived through massive periods of trauma, you know, like the Crusades and the Khmelnytsky massacres in the 17th century. I never came across, I'm not saying they don't exist, but I didn't see any in the book where anyone said, these are people talk about even their own family members being slaughtered. No one ever says it's not fair. What I do see, which is shocking, because it's one thing, you know, you're the psychology person, not me, I'm the history guy. You know, I've learned a long time ago when people are asking questions about suffering and they've suffered, don't give them an intellectual answer. Be empathetic. Right. They're not really interested.
There is no good intellectual answer to an emotional question. Yeah, absolutely.
But it doesn't mean there isn't an intellectual. It just means that not the answer the person can hear at the time, and you shouldn't be giving that. You shouldn't be giving right. it to them. But even people who are going through this like horrible things, people describing their own children being murdered in anti-Jewish violence, and they immediately, because they have such a profoundly deep understanding of so many different concepts, which are so far beyond what we could talk about now, about this world, the next world, and suffering, but truly understand the notion of individual collective responsibility of the Jewish people vis-a-vis our relationship with God as a unique, small, but oversized, important role we play in history, they're almost always owning it, saying it's because we are not doing what we are supposed to do, that this is happening to us. Which is, in my opinion, unbelievable, because I do believe the number one issue today in the world is the inability to take responsibility for things, you know, grow up. So, but when you operate with that kind of worldview, a lot of things that for us are very hard to accept, be it supernatural for good or for bad, because the highs and lows of Jewish history are all supernatural. The worst things happen to us of any people, and the best things happen to us of any people. But if you have like the proper Jewish software running as a background program in your brain, then you are capable of, and it shows you a tremendous level. Just, I don't know, I could do this. You know, God forbid something horrible would happen to some member of my family, I would be very angry. I'd be very upset. But you only see this, by the way, it's not really our topic we're focusing on, but you see people really starting to question, where is God, much more in the modern period when the whole question of God is being questioned in general.
Right. Meaning in the Enlightenment, when science begins to replace religion with this idea that, oh, you can't have those two things existing at the same time. That's the first time where people stop. They start asking a question like, where was God? Whereas before that, like, it's just obvious. That's just, there is no other reality other than what God is intervening in. So it's very interesting that it sort of falls out of fashion, but then it also carries with it, like, not only does it fall out of fashion, it literally becomes not the way we think anymore.
Exactly. That's exactly the point I would make, that if you don't have the basic software operating package that enables you to process external stimuli in a certain way, then you're just going to come to very different conclusions. We call in Judaism hashkafa, which is why I'm such a big, I'm almost fanatical in the importance of creating what's the foundation. It's the sort of like, it's like your basic software operating package about your process. Everything else is just the information you're adding in, but you have to begin from certain basic assumptions about reality, that if you're real with them, it not only changes how you understand what the whole story is about, but it changes how you understand what you're going through on an individual level or going to collectively, which brings us back to what we were, you know, kind of talking about at the beginning of understanding that we have to learn to, we live in a world today where we're being bombarded with so much stuff instantaneously. We've never been able to experience events live. Yeah. Like, imagine if they had smartphones at Pearl Harbor. Imagine what you would have seen. You know, like, you have a couple of famous clips of the Arizona, like, capsizing, you know. But it's we are so in the here now, and we're so bombarded, and there's no time to digest and process. Combination of not having the basic operating software combined with, I would say, it's a form of, you know, you probably can understand this better than I do, sensory overload.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Kind of makes it impossible for us to stand back and look at, like, whoa, let's hit the pause button, even though I'm in the middle of this. It's kind of like you see in these, you know, like they have the freeze frame and everyone stops and like, what's going on? I've seen movies with this happening. Like, what's going on here?
Right.
Because that's what we really need to do, which is what I think we really should do, is to kind of pull back and see, because it's, by the way, it's the nature of all human history that you can never understand what's going on as you're going through it. You always need some distance. You know, it's not, I'm not talking about a week. You know, right. You can look at 9/11 now. We're talking about, you know, more than 20 years later, and we have much more perspective on where it fit in and the consequences of what happened and what we learned
right,
from it.
Like what led up to it happening? Where were the failures? What were the successes? Why did, what did it mean at that time? It was like the beginning of the global jihadist movement in many ways, not the beginning, but one of the big kind of flash moments. So how do we apply it a little bit to what's going on now? How do we contextualize that? I know we only have a few minutes left today, but right. can we start with one piece that will help us have a bit of context in terms of this idea of the end of days and the time that we're in right now? How do we contextualize that? And then I suspect your intuition is right. We'll have to pick it up.
Next definitely. Episode. We have a lot more to talk about. I want to rush through it, but I think it's sort of like a cliffhanger, you know, next episode, and everyone will definitely tune in.
All right,
one of the concepts, you know, if you watch these, if you watch any of these or read any of these stories, these epic, you know, trilogy, whatever, you know, there's always, you know, we say the greatest danger is always at the end. Mm-hmm. The final showdown in these stories is the little superhero has to confront the big bad guy. And that in that's an idea that appears in Judaism as the concept of the wars of Gog and Magog, which are talked about. If you want to see where they're written, you have to go to the book of Ezekiel, Yeheskel, and Zechariah or Zechariah. And these are prophets who are in the late First Temple period, going back over 2,500 years ago. And they're getting a vision. You have to understand, we look at this, they talk about, and again, we'll continue. We'll go into this a little more next episode. But they're basically talking about a final showdown when the little superhero, the teeny Jewish people, are confronted by a massive coalition of different groups of people that unite to stop us from completing our mission, which is, in the case of the Jewish perspective, reconnecting humanity to God and elevating the world back to, you know, this as perfect a world as humanly possible, living under the values and that relationship with the creator of the universe, which is called the Wars of Gog and Magog. What's really important to understand, Ellie, when looking at these sources is prophets are, you know, Moses as a prophet is unique in his level of prophecy because he hears God speak, so to speak. So he's just acting as a secretary, literally. The first four books of the Bible are God dictating to Moses what he wants him to record. The book of Deuteronomy is Moses' own words. And God says, okay, put it in my book. And I put my stamp of approval on it. But other prophets, there's different levels of prophecy, would have visions. Some of them would be visions in a trance state. Some of them would be visions that they'd have in a dream state. But it's very important we look at these. If people want to do some homework before we get to the next episode and start looking up Ezekiel and Zechariah, you know, they are putting their own words to what they see. And what's most important when we go into this is not to be literal in it, because obviously imagine God shows Ezekiel Zechariah a vision of tanks and jet fighter planes and nuclear bombs and guns. None of this technology.
Right. They'd have no idea what that was.
Right. So what the prophets are being given is the images they can relate to. And from their perspective, so it's important not to get bogged down in the details, because even who we're talking about, it says Meshech and Tuvol and Gog and Magog,
right.
And commentators, the rabbis throughout history have gone kind of nuts on figuring out who it is and who it could
right.
be, the range of opinions, and we're not necessarily sure of all the details. And it isn't so important. The most important thing, like I said, before you get bogged down in the details, is to get the big picture. And what is clearly being shown is that a certain coalition of nations, seems to be a very large coalition of nations, lines up to confront the Jewish people and stop us from getting to what our destiny is, which is the completion of the reestablishment of our state, the ingathering of the exile, all the things that are supposed to be part of the messianic process of us reconstituting what we're supposed to be. That's the other problem, is we think, you know, diaspora, which is the Greek word for scattering, has gotten so comfortable and you've been in it for so long, we think it's normal. But normative Judaism, the creator of the universe created us as a nation to be in a specific piece of real estate, we're like a unique plug that only plugs into one outlet that enables right. us to function at our peak efficiency. That outlet is the land of Israel. to complete our mission in the world. It's a fundamental understanding that the Jewish people have to be back in the land of Israel. I always say, and it's becoming much clearer now than ever before, there's only two kinds of Jews: those who live in Israel and those who will be living in Israel. There is no
one. The first command to the first Jew is God to Abraham saying, you know, Lech Lecha, go to the land that I will show you. The commandment of relationship from God to human, and that the first commandment is to be in the land, like go to yourself and be in the land. Those are basically the first instructions.
Exactly. And by the way, even a lot of religious Jews kind of forgot that, because living in Lakewood and Muncie and Pico Robertson and Bathurst and something, or Northwest London, is very comfortable. But all of this process of what's going on, a physical, spiritual return, reunification of Jerusalem, is all part of the process of getting us back to the way we're supposed to be in the first place before we made mistakes that had huge consequences that led to destruction and exile and persecution and diaspora. So intrinsic in understanding of that is the concept that when we these things coalesce, and that this actual individual, the Messiah, will appear at some point in the middle of this process. We're not sure exactly when and what kind of donkey he rides, and all that's not important. But clearly, the forces that are against this recognize that these things coming together represent the marshaling of the strength of the Jewish people in our unique homeland as a people, spiritually, you know, united and focused and tapping into the incredible, you know, power that we have as a nation to transform the world. So they're going to make one final attempt, just like when you watch the Animal Channel shows, when a lion's hunting an animal like a baboon, and the baboon's cornered. It's going to be its most dangerous a minute before it's dead, because it knows this is my last desperation. All the adrenaline's pumping at 110%. And therefore, the forces that are antithetical to who we are and what our mission is are going to line up and make one final attempt when they see that things are moving against them in the direction they're supposed to be moving from our perspective to try and stop us. And that is what Gog and Magog is about in the general formulation of the scenario, without going into chariots and horses and who specific people are. And please God, when we continue next time, we can go look more into that and see exactly how that fits in more specifically to what the current events are, the actual things that we're reading and seeing in the news every day.
Awesome. Okay, so maybe this episode is sort of the beginning of the end of days. How do we understand that? What's the timing that we're in? Next week, we'll go very specifically, a little bit more detailed into this idea of Gog and Magog and how we understand, how is this going to play out? Because that's really ultimately what we want to know. Is there a way that we can have a sense of how this is going to play out? Okay.
And what we're supposed to do, more importantly.
What's our responsibility? True. Good reminder. Amazing. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. Please send us your questions, ideas for topics, anything that you'd like to know for myself or for Rabbi Spiro. We love hearing from you. And if you haven't had a chance, please like, subscribe, and share the podcast. We are getting a lot of great feedback, and we want to make sure that it gets out there to anybody who might be looking for this kind of information or these kinds of conversations. Thanks, everyone, for joining. Thanks, Rabbi Spiro.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Remember What's Next. If you would like to get more resources and information about Rabbi Ken Spiro, please check out his website at www.kenspiro.com. If you have a question or an idea for a topic, please email us at rememberwhatsnext@gmail.com.